Coming up, actor, screenwriter, and director D.B. Sweeney joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hi, everyone. I am Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Berg.
Hi, everybody.
We have a fantastic show. Again, I want to thank everyone for watching and listening, and tell your friends so we can keep interviewing great people from the movies.
Yes.
Like longtime friend today, D.B. Sweeney, who lives in Chicago, but we have him here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, we originally booked him to do a Skype interview, and he magically appeared.
He's making
today,
time so. For us. We're
yes.
we're going to be like inside the actor's studio, and when I, you know, used to be Chasen's people needed to go to, but now it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast.
Absolutely.
So it's great to see you. What is happening this week?
Thank you. Well, I wanted to talk to you about period pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Because DB's been in a few.
Many, as we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Memphis Belle, Lonesome Dove, of course.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you have been, Goodfellas is a period piece, isn't it?
Gosh, it's so funny when you said that. I was thinking of Rough Riders, I did,
which
was about Teddy Roosevelt.
Right.
That was a period piece. And I'm trying to think what other films that I did were truly period pieces. But yeah, some of those. Yeah. Films were.
Because that's specific to a time, though.
But I guess I was thinking of historical pieces.
Right.
I did a movie that never came out called Lost Eden, which was took place in the 1890s. It was about women who worked in the mills in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Oh, wow.
Very kind of interesting story. Didn't get made, but women that were finding their independence in the workplace.
Oh, fantastic.
Many years ago.
So when you're doing one of those pieces,
yes.
there are costumes, there mm-hmm. are sort of mannerisms and idioms,
right.
and there's language that is different from modern day. So how does that help you form your character? What do you use to get, you know, to the final product?
Well, it's interesting. When I was in acting school, when I was at the Neighborhood Playhouse, these were all things, you know, we would dabble in Shakespeare, Chekhov, mm-hmm. Moliere. So you were working very much, you know, with your body and posture, clothes. Obviously, the way that you dress is so completely different. I mean,
yes.
if you think of a film. It's interesting, the movie Barry Lyndon, which was on the other night, and every time it's on, I have to watch it. I love this film. But some people don't like it because they think that Ryan O'Neill is very contemporary in the film.
Mm.
I don't see that. I think it's great, and I think he's, you know, brilliant as the character. But it does catch my eye sometimes when people playing a period film and they seem too contemporary.
Yes.
or as I've often said, their clothes are too clean. That's another.
Yeah.
Like neat and pressed and just came off the wardrobe truck.
Right, they need to
Whereas
go
Whereas like some of these
the
older movies, you know, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, or some of these, you know, like John Wayne wore, you know, he wore the same outfit or the same hat. And so there was a certain continuity in all of his films.
Mm-hmm.
And I find some of the hardest things to do is that it's so foreign when you're, you know, when you're doing a period film, you know, you never get to wear the clothes. Don't ruin this. We only have one, you know, so you don't have the opportunity to walk in it and to really, you know, feel as if you're that character. I know that when I did Grace of My Heart, I was one of those people. I wanted all the sort of brassieres and girdles
yes.
of the day because
yes.
that really helped me. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted people to see me and, you know, that period dress, because I think
right.
I think it helps quite a bit and
yeah.
forms how you play the character.
I think you know this, I'm not sure, but I worked at Victoria's Secret for a long time.
Yes,
I did.
You told me.
I was the panty queen. And so, you know, when I used to actually wear like particular underpants and stuff that no one would see.
Wow. Are
only
there photos
I,
of this?
No,
wow.
no photos. Only I would know.
Yes.
But what I called it when I was competing in college on the speech circuit, I called it my competitive edge, because I knew what was going on under my clothes. Nobody else would know but me. Well, there was one friend of mine who she and I would go like, but anyway, yes. The whole point of that being you mm-hmm. carry yourself differently when you are wearing different, you know, especially things underneath, because like of certain course. Stuff doesn't fit right.
When we did Lost Eden, yeah. which was the 1860s, I mean, we, you know, it was insufferable. We couldn't breathe. We had to have
corsets,
these,
right?
Yeah, very, very heavy duty corsets. It was extremely hot, you know, and then working in the mills, of course, you know, that's a lot of women, you know, their hair would get caught in the machines and... I found it very tough. We'd have to rip everything off just so we could, you know, release our diaphragm and breathe.
Take a deep
breath. But I haven't done too many period films. Aside from like the 50s and the 60s has been my sweet spot. I've done a lot of films in that particular era, which I tend to gravitate towards.
I was just going to ask you, is that one of the ones that's your favorite, that sort of
probably.
Time?
My sweet spot is always kind of 1958 to 1963, pre-British invasion. I love films from that era. I love movie stars from that era. Mm-hmm. I love CinemaScope. You know, a lot of my favorite films fall in, you know, Sweet Smell of Success sort of fall into that area. And I'm not really sure why. Kind of a post-war malaise, I guess. I don't know. I like the clothes and the colors.
Are there mannerisms that you would use that would be, you know, of the time in particular, or sort of the way you would hold yourself that you would
I think,
find?
Again, it's just watching. I mean, one of the great things about YouTube is just watching how people carry themselves. You know, I watch the old Academy Awards and, you know, you see Joan Crawford come on and their compartment is just completely different, the way they walk, looking out at the audience. And, you know, nowadays we tend to, you know, everything. We look like a giant question mark. But I think, again, that, you know, they were going to dance class, singing class, speaking class. My grandfather, Melvin Douglas, very much was always on me about my speaking and my elocution. And I tend to fall back and mumble my words. And that's not something that they would do in the 1940s or 1950s. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love watching... the way people used to speak. It's just, they're not necessarily English. They just had a wonderful way of speaking. Mm-hmm. You know, when you watch somebody like Jacqueline Onassis or, I don't know, I love that formality.
I do too. I think it's really, it's quite lovely and something that you don't see very often, except in the movies. So.
It's hard in a film, you know, because again, we don't have the time. So if I were doing a film and you catch a mistake, like, oh God, that was, you know, not good. Can we redo that, or can we cut that little bit out, something like that? But it's something that I like to do. And when I'm shooting things, I don't usually include phones, anything that's modern. I just think it's ugly. You know, in the old days, you know, you'd see a movie and you never see a television or anything like that in the frame.
Right, right.
And so I prefer a frame that doesn't, you can't really tell what era that the film is
in. In order to keep people guessing, or just to keep them focused on the
I think it dates
at.
A movie to show, like, you know, they shot this in 1987,
right.
You know, so, or the hairdo. I try to keep everything neutral. So again, you could look at it not specifically. And I do the same thing with my jokes. I never do topical material. I try to keep everything very...
Keep it classic.
Yeah, very, very neutral.
Classic and neutral. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. Speaking of that, why don't we bring in our guest?
I'm very excited to have DB here. He, of course, you know him from his movies, Memphis Belle, Fire in the Sky, The Cutting Edge, TV appearances like Lonesome Dove, which is an incredible film. And, of course, he's been on Broadway, theaters. I love talking about you as you walk in. And you are a director. I've seen your film, Two Tickets to Paradise, and you've transitioned into being a director. Well, you know, one of the things I'm going to ask you about this, but I thought that this was, as the film's producer, you presented the screenings to soldiers and Marines on bases. I just want to start with that because that's... And then we're going to go back to our first question, which we always ask. But how did you get the idea to show your film? Because that's the hardest thing about making a film is, well, who's going to see my movie? You know, every step is hard. You go, this is the hardest part. And then the next thing happens. But the most important thing is trying to get an audience to see your film. And how did you get the idea to show it on Army bases?
Well, the idea to make the movie came from in the aftermath of September 11th. A lot of the guys I grew up with on Long Island became firemen and cops regular guys. And I know a lot of other guys that worked on the pile cleaning up the mess. So there was trauma to go around for everybody, and especially for the firemen, because, you know, over 300 firefighters obviously were killed, and they didn't have the funerals until they found the remains. So in the fall and winter of 2001 into the spring of 2002, there'd be, for my firemen friends, they would go to 3 or 4 funerals a week.
Wow.
So, and then after the funeral, you go to the bar and you get blitzed. And so in about January of 2002, I was sitting with two of my buddies. And, you know, they're younger than me, and they were looking 10 years older. And I said, you guys got to take a night off. You got to go to a movie or something. And they both fell on the floor laughing. Movies, they don't make movies for us anymore. And I just thought, you know what? Here's my job. So I started writing the movie that winter with my buddy Brian Curry, mm-hmm. who's from Worcester, Massachusetts. Who's from Massachusetts, and he had friends in the Worcester Fire, which was... 6 firemen died the year before, which was kind of overshadowed by 9/11. That was a great tragedy in Massachusetts. So anyway, we just tried to make a movie that was kind of an antidote to the Hollywood movies that say, you know, if you're a fireman, if you're a small town person, if you're, you know, that somehow your life and your experience and your values are not as important as other views. So that was the impetus.
Would you call that like a, because I sort of feel that way too, since the... you know, these blue collar movies. I mean, there was even a movie called Blue Collar that I saw when I was a kid. My grandfather was a steam fitter. My grandmother worked in a department store, and they were classic Italian, you know, lived in Queens. They were blue collar people. I was very influenced by them, and they loved going to the movies. But I agree with you, the movies sort of changed, like that audience for, you know, people seeing themselves, you know, changed.
Yeah, I think it's and the audience is still there, and every once in a while Hollywood stumbles onto it.
right.
Like Taken is a great example. I mean, Taken was not even going to come out in theaters in America. It was going to be released straight to DVD, and then it became a huge hit in Europe, and they were like, well, gee, I guess we better release it. And then, of course, became one of the biggest hits of the year, launched Liam Neeson into another level of stardom, and 2 sequels later. And so,
and a TV spinoff.
TV spinoff.
But nobody that lives within 15 miles of where we're talking right now understood the appeal of the movie. And that, to me, gets to the crux of it, and that's what I've tried to do in my work, not just when I write and direct, but, you know, I know that there's a huge audience out there of people who don't, you know, have a New York or L.A. perspective necessarily.
Yes, I know. All you have to do is travel. Usually what's so funny is when we go make these films, we find you're in Omaha and you meet all these great people that are not reflective of the rest of the country. Okay, I want to go back because we always start our show with my favorite question. What was the...
Can I just add one last thing about that? Because I didn't fully answer your question. So I made the movie for the firemen, but then I realized that, you know, a lot of the I had visited some soldiers before that, and they always get everything last. Like, you know, you're last in line for food, you're last in line for everything. And Hollywood uses the excuse, we can't take the movie out of the country because of piracy, but they really just don't care about people in the military and their families that much. So I thought, how cool would it be to go over to Iraq and show the movie and have the world premiere, like, you guys are first. And so that was the impetus of it. It was a huge ordeal to do that, but it was so worth it. And so that was why I ended up doing that. And then I want to do the same thing for the Navy, so I went on an aircraft carrier and did it for them as well.
That's incredible. So you had to. So this was a print, even a physical print.
No, DVD. I took a DVD.
So they got the DVD.
Yeah, they didn't really have it. I mean, just getting the print there would just. I mean,
I was already dating myself. Yeah.
No, but it was on a print at that point.
Oh,
but,
it was.
But, yeah, but it was like just logistically getting through all the helicopters and all the things you had to go through. I just couldn't make that happen.
That's amazing. I hope you have photos of that.
I do.
Of that experience. Okay, now let's go back. Let's go back in time to Long Island. We were talking about you growing up on Long Island. I have some relatives from Long Island. What was the first movie you saw and who took you to see it?
My mom and dad. I had 2 older sisters and a younger brother. It's 1969 or 1970, and my town was called Shoreham. The next town over was Rocky Point, and Rocky Point had a drive-in cinema where it was my dad was a school teacher, so we never need dough. So, but they had a thing where a certain nights of the week, it was $5 a carload. So for a big Irish family, that was a good value. You know, maybe make the popcorn at home, put it in a big garbage bag, and, you know, so that's a cheap night out for the family. So we went to see Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Oh, what a fabulous first film.
Yeah, it was great. And I think my dad had picked it and my mom had sort of approved it. And so we get in there and the kids are, I'm about 8 years old or 9 years old, and we're all in the station wagon, and you know, you're parked on the little mogul aiming up at the screen, and they take the thing and put it on the window. And I think that my mom thought we were just going to see like a Western, you know, shoot 'em up. And early in the movie, there's this kind of really sexy scene with Catherine Ross where her shirt's being open. It may or may not be consensual activity about to follow. It may be something more violent. Who knows? and my mom, who's very, you know, worried about her kids seeing this thing, immediately starts trying to, like, she puts the visor down and she's trying to block our view. And I remember trying to see around my mom and thinking that Catherine Ross was the most mysterious, beautiful creature I'd ever seen. And why are they hiding this from me? And so now when I see the movie, it's such a tame moment. But to my mom, but I have this, I'm imprinted with Catherine Ross for my entire life.
Well, I always, the drive-in for me too was very, I saw a lot of movies at the drive-in and it was always like nudity. That's the first place I saw nudity was at the drive-in, you know, swearing and, you know, because my, we would go there, like you said, cheap entertainment, or it revolved a lot around our social life. Like for kids, there was nothing to do. So we would do the Dusk Till Dawn, you know.
Two movies, right?
And then sometimes it was, but I was always the one like watching the movie.
Yeah.
Everybody else was like out, you know.
On the swings?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know, we had swings too. Yeah. That used to be code. I wrote about that in my book. Meet you at the swings was like makeout time.
You bet.
You know, but I was inside watching, you know. I was watching Carrie at the drive-in and all these. I saw a lot of great, you know, horror movies. Okay, so you grow up, and were there people, were there movies at the time that you liked, that you admired, the actors you liked that you were seeing on television or?
Well, either that year or a year later, right around that time, my dad took me into a real movie theater inside and we saw Patton. Mm. And Patton is one of my, I'd say, three favorite movies of all time. I watch it at least once a year. Usually I watch it on New Year's Eve. My wife likes to go to bed early, so I just open a bottle of champagne and watch Patton and spend New Year's with George C. Scott every year.
Okay, well, that's good. Every New Year's, I'm going to think of you.
Yeah, and you know, and Patton is a really significant movie in movie history because that's the movie that got Francis Coppola the chance to direct The Godfather. Mm-hmm. So because the script was so good and the movie made so much money, and so I that was a movie that made a big impression on me. And you know, my dad used to like watch a lot of World War II war movies anyway. And I remember I used to watch this TV show, The Rat Patrol. I was playing sports. I wasn't really focused on it. It was just sort of like an interesting thing to check in on once in a while.
But that's so interesting that your dad, you saw all these war movies because then you end up doing a lot war movies. So there always is a kind of a certain symmetry. And as you're saying Coppola, I'm thinking, and then you worked with Coppola.
Yeah, he gave me my big break. So it is weird how, I don't know whether there's where you put it out there in the universe and then it circles back or.
Well, I believe so. I mean, that's always for me, these kind of, you know, whether you know it or not, there's a pattern, you know, when you see films that, you know, and they get into your brain and they, you know, become things that, again, you end up meeting or working with the people, you know, that you like. Okay, so before that, Gardens of Stone, you decided to go to NYU.
Yeah, well, I was a baseball player, so I was in New Orleans, Tulane University. I got injured, and baseball didn't look like it was going to be my future, so I went back home to New York. And my sister was at NYU, and my dad at that point had become a guidance counselor in high school, and he was all about, you got to be in college, you got to be in college, and I didn't have any money, and he didn't have any money, and so, but my sister was at NYU, so it seemed like that could be possible, but I really didn't want to study or have any books or anything, so I just, I had done a play as a senior in high school, and it was fun, and people said you were good at it, so I thought, all right, well, maybe I'll do that for a while before life kicks in.
Yeah.
And I'll just go, you know, I'll just do that for a couple of years and then maybe try to sneak my way into law school or get some kind of a straight job or, you know, whatever.
Right.
I had no idea. I was 18 years old. And so I auditioned for NYU And I didn't even know. They told me you had to have a monologue, and I had no idea what that was. So they said, well, it's just somebody talking, and it, you know, you get it from a play. And I was like, okay. And it says, does it have to be from a play? Because I didn't really know any plays. Yeah. So I took my favorite book was The Catcher in the Rye. Mm-hmm. So I took there's a monologue in the book late in the story where he talks about it, when his brother died. Mm-hmm. And he's got a baseball glove, and I was a baseball player, and I thought, well, I know how special a baseball glove is. So I gave this audition, and they put me in, and they gave me a little bit of like a scholarship from Charlie Chaplin's widow, Paulette Goddard. I got some money from her, and so you know, it was kind of cool. It all came together. I still had to drive a taxi. I had to cook. I had to I had to make up a lot of the difference between this small scholarship and the tuition, mm-hmm. which now I don't know how people pay it now. I think it was less than $10,000 when I was there. Now it's like 60 or something.
And where are you living now and when you're in New York?
Well, that's the thing. Because I'm from Long Island, I'm not eligible for a dormitory. Like if you're from within 60 miles, and NYU has a lot more dorms now, but at that time they only had dorms for like 15% of the students. So if you were from a place within 75 miles of the school, which I was like 71 miles away out of Long Island, you can't get one. So I'm scrapping now. I'm living on couches. I'm getting a share. We'd have like three guys in a one bedroom, you know, all that kind of thing.
Remember those days.
So, yeah, and it was just, so I wouldn't really want my kids to go to NYU because of that experience that I had. Like I saw other kids in college that I'd go visit, and they'd be on the quad with a Frisbee and drinking from a keg of beer and going to the football game and like being in college. And I was like in the rat race already. So It was very instructive. It got me going fast in my career. Like, all right, got to make money, got to hustle. But I did kind of lost out on the college experience.
And what were the acting styles that they were teaching? Like, I went to the Neighborhood Playhouse, so it was strictly Meisner technique. I picked up some other techniques, but what were they teaching at NYU?
It was a great business model for NYU. They took all your tuition money, and then they farmed you out Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to five different studios around Manhattan, either Stella Adler Studio or Circle in the Square Theater School or Lee Strasberg Theater. And there was one other one. And then their own in-house theater was called Experimental Theater Wing. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty interesting. Like Elizabeth Swados was Swados, however you say her name.
Yes.
She was there.
Runaways.
And so they had some interesting teachers. And so I went to Circle in the Square because I, you know, thinking about like money, I was like, well, they have a theater. Maybe I could get a job there someday. Yeah. You know, I mean, so I just thought, so I went there and I studied for 2.5 years there. And they had a rule that if you studied there, you couldn't audition for the plays, which I just thought was so wrong. So, but anyway, I got around it. I met the stage manager and snuck in the back door and auditioned and got my first job at the Circle in the Square Theater on a Broadway play called The Caine Mutiny Court Martial.
Now, is this the one with Michael Moriarty?
That's the one. And Joe Namath.
Oh my God, this is our second Michael Moriarty shout out in our doing the show. Where are you? Like, I saw that performance, because that's when I would have been in New York in acting school, and I remember seeing him, very quiet, very, you know, if anyone's seen the movie. Had you seen the movie before?
When I started getting interested in acting, I realized that my favorite actor was Humphrey Bogart, and so I started watching every movie he ever did. Yeah. And he was so good in Caine Mutiny Court Martial. Oh. He's still good in everything. He's still my favorite. And so I was studying that. So I thought it was kind of cool that I could be, you know, sort of like one degree of separation from Humphrey Bogart.
Of course.
You know, so that was, I really enjoyed that experience.
That must have been. So, I mean, your first gig is on Broadway. I mean, were you nervous at all? Or?
Well, I was a senior at NYU. I wasn't even out yet. So I went down to NYU and I said, well, I guess I don't need you guys anymore. I got a job. And they said, no, keep a journal and we'll give you a degree when you're done. And then they tried to shake me down for more money. So I said, you know what? I don't really need the degree, you know. And but then I had a lawyer a few years later who was really sharp. And he said, I got my first movie part. And he goes, he sent a letter to NYU saying, Paramount Pictures wants to know if they should include the fact that D.B. Sweeney is a graduate of NYU in his bio. I had a diploma at FedEx. Back when FedEx was special, in like 2 days, I had a diploma. So that was a good lawyer move right there. That was
very clever.
Yeah. Very smart. So, did you pick up any advice from the great Michael Moriarty? Again, part of my childhood drive-in experiences. Report to the Commissioner was a movie I saw.
He's a tremendous actor, but he's a nutty guy.
Yeah.
And I used to sit and play. I was more excited, honestly, about Joe Namath came into the play 2 weeks after me. So I made my Broadway debut with Broadway Joe Namath. So in places every night, it would be me and Joe and Michael Moriarty in this little curtain and in the tiny little area and 6 feet away on the other side of this curtain is the audience, And Moriarty would like expound on all his conspiracies and all these things that are going on. Love and it. Joe and I are sitting here just thinking, they can hear you, number one. And number two, shut up. We're trying to remember what we're supposed to say. I only had one line, but Joe had a lot of lines. And, you know, I was just trying to make sure I went in at the right time. I was like the bailiff. My job was like to open the door as each witness came in and close it and sit down. And so... But I found out that you got an extra $10 a week if you understudied another part. Mm-hmm. So every week I'd learn another, like it's a series of witnesses in the play. And so I'd learn another part, and then I'd go into the producer, Paul Libin, and I'd say, excuse me, Mr. Libin, I'd like to apply to be the understudy. And he'd glad to not have to pay somebody else to do it. So after about 6 weeks, I was understudying six different roles, and I had memorized the whole play. And then in the last week of the run, Scott Burkholder, very good actor, left to do some TV job. The play was closing. Mm-hmm. And I got to do his part in the first act, which is a comic part. And then there was an agent in the audience. I got seen. It was crazy. So it all.
That's great. So an agent sees you. What agency?
Well, it's Kevin Huvane.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I was his first client.
It's like Shirley MacLaine and, you know, being. So Kevin Huvane.
Yeah. He was at William Morris at that time, and he saw me, it was at Joe Allen's in the Broadway restaurant in between shows on Wednesday, and there's like 30 guys in the play, and so we go over to Joe Allen's because, you know, you're supposed to have a drink when you make your Broadway debut, like a toast.
Yeah.
And even though we had two shows that day, you know, we went to Joe Allen's anyway, and he came there and gave me his card in front of the whole cast. It was crazy.
Oh, my God.
So it was kinda,
Cinderella story.
Yeah, it was good.
Life is like a movie.
So he says, kid, so you start auditioning.
Yes.
Right before Gardens of Stone. Was there anything you didn't get, or did you just?
No, I didn't get a lot of things. Like, but I was in the mix. Like, I was going and having auditions. Sidney Lumet gave me a part where I had I was in Power, and I had one line in that. I had one line in the Broadway play, one line in Power, and Sidney Lumet is the only director that ever hired me on the spot, which was so exciting to have Sidney Lumet just say, "You're very good. You're in the movie." I was like, "What? What? Really?"
And so, you mean after you auditioned?
After I auditioned, in the room, he was like, "You're very good. You're in the movie." And he has this, tell him which day he's going to be and the whole thing. And so I go, it's this Denzel Washington, Richard Gere political movie. And we're filming my scene on the Brooklyn waterfront. But Sidney Lumet moves so fast that they want me to be there, like in a lower Manhattan supermarket, to do another scene. And then I'll ride around in the van and they'll get to my scene. So 4 hours later, we're on the Brooklyn waterfront. And I'm a college student being interviewed in this political campaign commercial. Mm-hmm. And so he goes, do you know your line? And I was like, yeah. He goes, no, hang on. Let's try one. So he goes, and he's action. I'd never seen any of that stuff. And it was, and I said, my line was, the person goes, so what do you think about somebody from New Mexico running for governor of New York? And my line was, from New Mexico? Is this some sort of affirmative action thing? And it cut, and he goes, and they had a truck where the video assist was and everything.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, well, I think it was okay. he walks up to the truck, he goes in the back, closes the door, and the truck drives away. And somebody comes over and takes my backpack, and I thought I was fired. I thought I was so bad that he drove away. But I didn't realize that Sidney Lumet was famous for like one take. That was his thing. So I begged the driver to take me to the next place where they were filming. And I was almost in tears, and I said, Mr. Lumet, I can do it better. I promise, if you just give me one more chance. And he was like, kid, it was perfect. What could I change? And then I literally thought I got fired.
What a great story. Oh, that's amazing. Did you ever get to talk to him years later?
He hired me to be in a play years later in the Hamptons, a play by Cynthia Ozick called Blue Light with the great Diane Wiest and Mercedes Rule. And,
wow.
It was the play wasn't as good as they were,
and
I had the unfortunate part of being in a kind of an underwritten role against them.
Right.
So it was like Diane Weiss was playing a Holocaust survivor, who's like hallucinating, and Mercedes was her daughter, and I'm basically playing like the human embodiment of Holocaust denial with no good lines. So it was a little tricky.
That sounds like the play I did with Mark Ruffalo, and we were leaving Playwrights Horizon and depressed enough, and then someone in the audience was putting on their raincoat, and as we were crossing the lobby, the guy goes to his wife, well, that was a long day's journey into I don't know what. And we literally both went, oh, like it was like my life, probably one of my lowest, you know, when you're, there's nothing worse than doing a play and you don't, you're just killing yourself out there trying to make something and it's not, something's missing and you don't quite know, you know,
yeah,
what it is.
Well, Alan Alda came backstage. Bob Dishy was in that play also, and he was wonderful, and he's a friend of Alan Alda. And Alan Alda came backstage, and we're in this tiny little backstage East Hampton theater. And Alan Alda said something like negative about me, like I was 3 feet away from him, and yeah. I turned around.
Hey,
like, Alan Alda. It was like, you know, I don't know, the world I come from with sports, this is the part where I hit you in the face. So like, but I didn't say that, but I kind of gave him that look, and he didn't act like he was saying it for my benefit. I don't even remember what it was, but it was just sort of, and it was true. I mean, yeah. I was bad in the play. The role wasn't well written. There was nothing I could really do.
I know, but still.
But it was just like, I just thought, man. So I never really go backstage anymore just because I always feel like it's too fraught with something.
Oh, there's nothing worse than like, that's why I say, like, when we used to wait downstairs, you know, not.
Hope somebody will come down and say something to make it all worth it.
Well, you know what Jeff Goldblum's is? I'm going to ruin it. He goes, you're genius. You're a genius. You're a genius. You just keep saying that.
Well, I actually learned a Sundance trick that's similar to this for screenings. Like, I never go to the movie. I just go to the party. Because then you don't have to have an opinion. So I never go to a screening at Sundance. So if anybody that knows me asked me, did I see your movie? I didn't see. And I keep myself clean.
Yeah.
Because, you know, 9 out of 10 movies at Sundance are terrible. Like 9 out of 10 of all movies. And so I'd rather wait until the festival's over. Mm-hmm. And then everybody else did the hard work of watching the bad ones. And they can curate the one that's worth seeing for me.
I try to pick something that's positive. I really try, and then if it's no good, I can't go to the party. I can't.
You just
I can't go to like a luncheon.
I like the parties too much though to have the movie ruin them. So
I'm so nervous. You know, I don't want to run. You know, because I feel like my thoughts are like ticker tape. They're gonna be like, you hated it, right? No.
See, in my world, we go, look at you. Congratulations.
Yeah, see, I would know that, right?
Just.
I would read right through that.
Yeah, that was not good.
Maybe like, it's just my line read. Other people
no,
do it
no,
better.
It's almost.
This theater's incredible, you guys. You should be so happy.
We got a lot of snow today.
Yeah, right.
I can't do it. I can't. Later on, I can. I'll say, like, if it's a close friend, I go, we'll talk later. Mm. Like, meaning, we can't talk. The director's right there.
I loved you.
You were great.
You were great.
You were great. We were always great.
Yeah, we needed more of you. That would have fixed it.
That would have.
Yeah.
For sure.
So I want to get to, of course, then you're in Gardens of Stone. The cast list alone is just incredible. You're getting to work with James Caan. I mean, were you freaking out? Angelica Houston?
From the very beginning.
Coppola?
I had my second callback. It was in Washington, D.C., in the Kennedy Center, in the basement of the Kennedy Center. They have, like, this rehearsal room. It's like a movie scene.
Yeah.
Coppola's 100 yards across the room. There's mirrors everywhere. He's sitting there with, like, two assistants and a chair. And, like, I have to walk 100 yards across the room to do my audition. And Fred Roos is there, the great casting director who cast The Godfather. And he had been advocating for me because he tried to put me in a movie about a baseball player a few years earlier. And it was like a three-scene part in a forgettable movie called 7 Minutes in Heaven or something about teenage girls. And I'm supposed to be the baseball player crush.
Right.
The director didn't want any part of me. And Fred was so mad that she wouldn't take his word that he made it his mission to get me in something. And luckily, something was the Coppola movie that came along next. But I had been used to, you know, I hadn't been struggling that long. I mean, it'd been a couple years of not getting the part.
Right.
And I knew that I had heard that Matt Dillon and Timothy Hutton and some other people were being talked about. So I figured, I'm not going to get this. So I started trying to figure out other smaller parts in the movie that I could be. Mm-hmm. So in my second callback, I was pitching Francis, like, I could be Wildman because, you know, like, I'm kind of wild, you know. And I'm like, and he's like, you don't think you're going to be Jack Willow? And I said, well, I mean, come on. Honestly, you know, you're not going to pick me. So, like, but I could be in one of these other parts, and then maybe another movie you make, I'll be a bigger part. And I really meant it.
Yeah.
I was just trying to get in the movie somehow.
Yeah.
And then I got the part. So,
That's incredible. I feel like that's amazing that he, I believe that so much of directing is casting and casting the right, you know, the right.
That's what he said. He said the director's most important job, get the script as good as you can get it, cast the right people, and then try not to screw it up on the set.
You've got to get philosophy. The right cast and the right symmetry, and the, you know, and by casting, again, my other word I always use, tone. You get the tone. Right. You know, right, but when somebody sort of, you know, sticks out. And so what was your experience, you know, I mean, just working with Coppola?
Well, the first...
How do you meet James Caan, though? He's like, I always have that, like, okay, or am I going to be... do you debate, like, how many days before I mention The Godfather? Are you, like...
I didn't really know what to do. I'd never been in it. So now I go back to New York, and then I come back to start the rehearsals in that same rehearsal room, in that same room, which now has a big, long table with James Caan, James Earl Jones, and Dean Stockwell, and, you know, and all these people. And because my flight was later or something, I get there, I'm a little... everybody else is seated. And I come in, and I'm sort of like, I'm the nobody, and everybody else has been on TV, and I'm late. And so I walk in there, and I kind of sit down, and Coppola, in hindsight, was loving the tension of it, loving the whole drama of the moment. I'd wanted to crawl under the table. And there was like a long pause, and Jimmy Caan, three or four chairs down, he kind of got up, and in the most charming way, kind of come over and said, "Hey, I'm Jimmy. Welcome. Aww. Nice to meet you." You know, and it was a very nice gesture that he, you know, for him to do that. It was great. But through the shooting of the movie, James Earl Jones was the guy who really, you know, helped me so much because, tragically, Francis's son was killed after 3 days of filming, and Francis, understandably, kind of retreated into a shell. He was directing from the trailer, and so here I am. I got the starring role in this movie. I could use a little help here. You know, I could use, you know, and you know, the loss the Coppola family had is so much bigger than my situation. So I understood that, but at the same time, you're thinking, you know, people aren't going to know that when they see the movie. They're just going to think you're not very good.
Yeah.
You know? So James Earl Jones was very generous with me, and not even that he said a lot of things. He just would. Jordan Cronenworth shot the movie. He was one of the great directors of photography. Mm-hmm. Passed away, unfortunately. Shot Altered States, and you know, so many great, great movies. And he was not fast. I mean, he had Parkinson's at the time, and he was meticulous. Like, you know, he would walk over, and it would take him like 30 seconds to walk 10 feet, and then he'd go over it, and he'd like take your glass, and he'd go, and then he'd walk. So it'd take him an hour and a half, whatever. It was always worth it. And you see the movie, and it's like, oh my God, look at that glint in the glass.
It's yeah.
But he was very slow, and James Earl Jones never left the set. Like, I was trying to figure out what I should do and how to act in the scene, and he would just sit there, and he would just sort of, you know, sit there and smile, and if I wanted to run my lines with him, he would do it. But he wasn't like trying to be like, you know, papa actor or anything like that.
Right.
He was saying by being there, like, you know, we'll get through it. You know, you're fine. It's good.
I can't imagine what that must be like. And I can't even think of another movie where something like that has even occurred. What, I mean, was there a thought that the movie would be shut down completely?
I figured we'd go home. We started 2 hours late the next day. And it was a scene with a helicopter. It was very loud, and you know, you couldn't hear what was going on. And I just thought, and then we filmed for like two more days, and then Francis literally keeled over in a scene. He almost hit his head on this locker, and he keeled over. It took him out in an ambulance, and then we shut down for like a week or something. But I thought the movie we'd go home. But apparently Francis didn't want to go home to face, you know, his son's room, and you know, this would help him through. So.
And do you think that emotion hovers in the film?
Yes, in a bad way. In a bad way, in that it's a very sad movie. My character is he's sort of the dead son of James Caan, in a sense, in a narrative sense. And I think that had that tragedy not occurred, Francis would have found ways to make to leaven it with more humor, more tenderness, more humanity. Instead, the movie's very cold and sad, which is where he was.
Right.
I think it's a very good movie, but I think it was hard for people to watch because of it's just the oppressive sadness of it. Like, for example, my character dies at the end of the movie.
Right.
That was the story. Francis takes that in the edit. He takes the scene and puts it at the beginning of the movie. He's like, the movie starts and ends with death. So we kill my character.
Yeah.
And then you ask the audience to invest in this character. You know, this character's dead. It was a weird choice, I thought.
Did you have survivor's guilt in any way? Because you're playing, I mean, that to me, it's like, I can't even imagine it. Like, you can't, it's your first part in a movie, and you go from being so excited to, I guess I can't express any joy.
It was very hard for all of us because Griffin O'Neill was the guy who was driving the boat that mm-hmm. caused the accident that killed Gio. And he was out of control. He'd already been arrested twice during the rehearsal period. Once for, Gio loved cars. You know, the movie Tucker was one of, mm-hmm. he worked on that. That was dedicated to him. But that was his passion. So, mm-hmm. and he was also one of those guys that could just talk his way. You know, he was a great talker. And so Gio talked to an exotic car dealer near in the Washington, D.C. area and got him to loan him, like, it was a Lamborghini or something crazy. And Gio let Griffin drive it. And so the Key Bridge is, like, you know, right, one of the scenic spots in Washington, D.C., and our hotel's right in Arlington, right across. He got arrested for going 120 miles an hour over the Key Bridge. It's like a 30-mile zone, you know, in the Washington area. You know, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. And then he got arrested for pulling a fire alarm in the hotel. Like he was just out of control. And this, right. So this was the third thing. So in hindsight, I think I'm sure maybe Larry Fishburne feels the same way. And you know that we wish we had kept a closer eye on Griffin.
Right. So. I think that you know when you're doing a film, there is a certain invincibility of you know right. we're filming it, so
they'll
nothing is ever you know you're called upon to do sometimes very you know kind of dangerous. Things. So after that movie, you then get cast in another movie, another period movie, Memphis Belle, which is so you go from a sort of Vietnam type war movie to now being in Memphis Belle. Speaking of danger, that film also was fraught with danger, wasn't it?
Very much. That's the last of its era before visual effects really took over movies. So we had 6 B-17s and 12 fighter planes and 2 camera planes. Jeez. And we would and every day when you see planes in that movie, it's real B-17s flying around. And one of them crashed during the filming. And it turns out later that it was owned by the French government, and and there was a conspiracy theory that the French government was trying to get out from under the plane because the planes had no resale value,
right.
but they cost hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to maintain. So the pilots were these French guys, Pierre. It just sounds like a bad story, but his name was Pierre. And we used to all go, when you weren't filming, we'd all get in the planes because they needed extras to like act like they were at the gun. So you'd put on a hat and a jacket and you'd sit at the gun when you flew by the camera plane. So people would go up, stunt guys would go up, people would go up with their girlfriend or whatever. So this plane goes about 300 feet up in the air and then comes down. It came down like it was intentionally coming down, like he was just trying to break the plane.
Yeah.
But B-17s were made out of magnesium, was the lightest metal at the time. Magnesium is more flammable than paper. So this thing caught fire and was burned up in 6 minutes. But they got everybody off the plane. One of the guy's girlfriends was strapped to her seat on her side, screaming hysterical. And she didn't want to move, and she was like, get away. And so Pierre knocked her out, put her on his shoulder, and carried her out. So he was our favorite Frenchman for the rest of the filming.
Wow, this sounds like, you know, movie making, like, you know, back in the silent era something, you know.
I mean, you'd never do it today. I mean, in the interior scenes, we had, like, mock-ups at Pinewood Studios where they would move the camera around. And our camera operator was the camera operator on The African Queen. So I was like...
Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah, so I would sit by him every day and just wait for something to spill out of him. And it was just a great experience in every way. But it'll never happen again because the expense of running those planes and having us all in England and all those things, they just do it now in Culver Studio.
That director, Michael Caton Jones, I remember from he did Brideshead Revisited, was one of the things he did. But did he go through the same danger? Was he down drinking tea while you guys were all up?
No, he was very serious. He was a serious guy. I was very grateful to him because I met him in Oxford, England. I went over to pitch a movie to a guy named Rick Stevenson, who used to work for Robert Redford.
Uh-huh.
And he's a great guy. He's a Seattle filmmaker. He made a few films. And so I went over to pitch him this idea that I had about Paul Watson. He's a guy, one of the founders of Greenpeace, who got kicked out. And he was the guy with the harpoons, you know, trying to save the seals and everything. And now he's got I think it's called Sea Shepherd now, the show. So I want to make a movie about him. So I flew to England to meet Rick Stevenson. And the day I got there, he got promoted by Robert Redford to run his whole company. He was like, look, I can't talk to you, but have a great week. And I was like, oh, okay. So I went to the pub, which what else are you going to do at Oxford? And I met Michael Caton Jones, who had just done a short film and was there kind of trying to make connections and everything also. Mm-hmm. And he and I just became fast friends. And then he made a movie a year later called Scandal, which became a big hit. Mm-hmm. And so then he came out to L.A. to make Memphis Belle, and he told CAA, he said, you can't cast any roles until I talk to D.B. Sweeney, because he can have his pick.
Wow.
So I picked the Navigator because my uncle flew a B-17 as a Navigator in World War II.
That's incredible. And both of these movies are all very with a lot of men.
Yes.
Have you I'm guessing it looks like you've worked more in the, you know, in the jostling on the call sheet for 20.
Yeah, Lonesome Dove, same thing. But the movie that I think most people know me from, if I'm in an airport, is The Cutting Edge. And that's very much like a girl.
I know, but that's what I was going to.
That's my only one, and that's the one that works.
That's why it's so funny. I'm getting ahead of myself.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But no, it's just because that's why I was thinking of that. But that, you know, you're the sweet guy on The Cutting Edge. So then you go, now this is, we're going into, we're talking to Bobcat Goldthwait, talking about cult classics. Is Fire in the Sky considered a cult classic?
I think so.
It's an incredible film. I love that film. And our good friend Robert Patrick also in that film.
Can't beat Robert Patrick. No better guy.
Oh, my God. You must have had a lot of fun on that movie.
We did have a lot of fun. I thought...
That's a blue-collar movie.
Very much. Very much. Guys cutting trees down. And
great story.
And it's a good story. I felt there was a... At this point, like I'm... I guess I'm... 11 years as an actor, maybe 7 years in the movie business. And I feel like I know a few things. And so, but I'm not, you know, trying to impose myself. When they hired James Garner, I thought we were dead. Because in the script, James Garner is wrong. And we spend 40 minutes going through this thing. And the audience already knows James Garner is wrong.
Right.
And I thought the audience is going to be annoyed that James Garner is wrong. Because he's James Garner.
Uh-huh.
So I thought... And I really feel like when you watch the movie, we're having these lie detector tests and they're trying to, and it's like, but James Garner is going to be turned out to be wrong. And that just, it's not, there's something out of symmetry with that. Like it should be some other actor.
Right.
That you wouldn't mind being not seeing it.
Yeah. Being wrong.
Yeah.
But so when you're doing the, had you been aware of this incident before?
No. No, I wasn't.
Really?
No, and it was just one of those lucky moments in my career. Like, I think that was probably the year that I was the most in demand of my entire career. And so there were a lot of scripts that I was getting to look at, and here we'll give you this one if you like it. And
wow.
You know, it was a very heady time, and I just thought it was a great story. And I thought it would be cool. And I wanted to play Spider-Man. And so at that time, James Cameron had the rights to Spider-Man. And so I found out through some people that the guys who were going to do the weightless scenes with me in Fire in the Sky were James Cameron's guys at Industrial Light and Magic. And so I thought, I'm going to audition by doing this movie. I'm going to show James Cameron how good I am on wires. Because I thought, how else are you going to make Spider-Man?
Right.
Except being on wires. So that was my strategy for doing that movie. It was my audition for Spider-Man. And of course, they didn't make Spider-Man for another 10 years or something. But
well, maybe you could still be...
who knows?
You know.
I could be like ancient arachnid man or something.
So my... come in. My aching back.
Yeah. Oh.
So the here's the stupid question: how do you prepare? How does an actor? You've gone through all these experiences. You were trained. You worked in films, and yet how do you prepare to be? You go, all right. Well, here's the scene. A Monday, Friday at 2:00. This to me is the classic actor problem. You're like, oh, okay, we're doing the alien abduction today. Nothing in my life prepares me for this. So how do you go about, you know, preparing for something like that?
I'm not particularly a methody actor, but that movie I was acting by myself a lot. And that was the first time I ever was on a green screen. So I didn't know what that was all about. But I remember for me that we had this one scene where I wake up like in this pod and I've got this goop on me. And the goop that they use was like, you know, when, in the grocery store when they want to sell you like a pound of meat, but they only have like 15 ounces, they put like some brown goop in there. So that was kind of the gelatin stuff.
Yes.
And you know, it was all clean and new or whatever.
Yeah.
But it had a texture of sort of like just like bird diarrhea or something. You know, it was really not. And so that was like one of the times when I used my stupid sense memory training. I was like, what if this really smells like, you know, fecal?
Right.
and you wake up in that and you can't see and you're sore. And so I've just kind of, so that was a big part of it. And then once we started filming the weightless stuff, they did something so smart. Whenever you see weightless stuff, usually you can tell, you can see where the wires are, even when they take them out, because it's right in the middle point.
Yeah, yeah.
So what they did with me was they hung me upside down and then turned the camera over. And the set was built upside down.
Wow.
So smart, because now you can't really tell which is up and what's down.
Right.
But it forced me to arch my back up for 10, 11 hours a day. So after a couple of days, I was super sore.
Yeah.
So I, you know, it's like a gift from the movie gods. I feel like this character who got dragged onto a spaceship would feel.
Right.
You know, just beat up and stinky and you know, there's all crap all over my wardrobe. And so, and that was a big lesson to me that, you know, the movie will present itself to you if you are open to it.
Yes.
Whatever it is. And maybe there's, and in other movies, there's been more subtle things like there'll be a very wise person on the crew who maybe is a lighting guy or a makeup artist or something. And their energy is exactly right for the character, not to imitate their speech or anything like that, but something about their energy is right. And
right.
So I try to spend time with that person. And it's hard to exactly put your finger on it, but, you know, sometimes, like if you want to play drunk, one trick that I learned, every young actor, I think, has a story where he did a play and I'm going to be drunk tonight. I'm going to be so good.
Right.
And it, of course, it doesn't work because you can't remember anything. But but the first time I got really, really sick was on Wild Turkey Bourbon. And so anytime I have to play drunk, I just take a little capful of that and I put it in my hair. And I immediately am just hammered.
That's so interesting.
Because it just triggers that revulsion, you know, that you feel when you're like that.
And so when you're doing a scene like that and you break for lunch, that to me is always the hardest. How do you how do you get back into it?
Yeah, that was really hard for me because, you know, growing up in a big family, if there was like six pork chops and four kids, you better eat fast and get as much as you can, you know, get going. And so, you know, they give you a big tray on the movie set, and there's on the Coppola movie or movies like that, there's sushi and they're carving a side of beef and gravy, and it's like Thanksgiving every day. And and so I learned very early on you can't eat.
Yeah.
Because you just get torpor and you got to sleep. And so, you know, I try to eat just a little tiny bit, but lunch is the hardest part of the movie set.
It's
because you get in conversations you don't want to be in. It's really hard. And so that's the part of that's the only time when I would go to my trailer or cubbyhole, whatever they gave me on the particular movie.
Yeah.
Because it's just too many things that can take you off your rails.
Mm-hmm. And going into the movie, just talking a little bit about extraterrestrials, is it something you believe in? After the movie, did you believe in it?
I've heard a lot of stories now. I mean, if I'm sitting in an airport bar or something like that, I can always tell when somebody's about to tell me about their abduction.
I love it.
And so, and I've heard some great, great stories. I kind of believe
it.
You're
like, I played one in the movie.
I'm not really the guy.
Were you nervous afterwards? Or you're like going to see? I wouldn't want to be. See an extraterrestrial.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It was
because, enough problems.
So, yeah, well, and so many things in my life, like we were talking about before, tend to follow. Like these things do kind of link up. So I definitely was aware of that already at that time. But no, I wasn't afraid that I was going to get abducted or anything like that. But I was afraid that some crazy people who think they were abducted might think they should kill me or something because I'm friends with them or I don't know, friends with the alien. I mean, I don't know.
Yes.
I definitely had that because some very disturbed people would come up to me from time to time. And your movie brought me right back to my abduction.
Oh,
and when a conversation starts like that, you got to look for the safety hatch somehow. I mean, you know, there's got to be a door to this room somewhere that I can get out right now.
Well, again, it's a testament to the films, you know, and the roles that we play. And then, you know, are you torn because you feel sympathetic?
Yeah.
You know, you did the movie. You made them feel this way. You know,
you
made them feel they weren't alone, you know.
And I love hearing the stories. I mean, the stories are a lot of them are similar. And I feel like they're influenced by movies. And people's dreams become kind of mixed in with movies. And then it comes out in this new story that they really believe is true.
Yes.
But sometimes it's just fascinating the details they remember and the sadness or the exhilaration. They're usually great stories. So I don't mind them that much.
So playing a character and nobody believes you, what do you do for that? Because that's something interesting, you know, the character to that must be horrible and humiliating. You've been through this experience and then everybody turns on you.
Yeah, I thought the script was good in that regard, and you know, I feel like when the script's good, lean on it, and when it's not, make something up.
Right.
And in that case, I felt like, you know, I felt, you know, I've been on a lot of teams, and, you know, everybody growing up, there's times when you're not in the in-group, and you know, you're rejected. And so I think that, and every actor has 1,000 rejection stories, so
yeah.
That stuff is all pretty easily accessible, and I became very good friends with both Pete Berg, who's become a terrific director.
Oh, fantastic. And
Robert Patrick, and we would all play golf together, and so I would play little games with myself, like, you know, I would pretend that, like, if they were talking by the coffee thing, I would put something very specific into Robert's mouth that he's whispering to Pete,
yeah,
about me, and then just say it over and over to myself until I could believe it enough.
Yeah.
And then, you know, because those were my friends, you know, so
yeah.
I would just imagine them, they're playing the parts, instead of imagining their character names, you know, that's Pete and Robert, and why would they say that about me? And then just kind of just hypnotize yourself in a way.
Well, I think being on a movie creates paranoia anyway.
Always,
whenever I see someone whispering, like you said with Sidney Lumet, I'm like, am I fired? Am I through?
Yeah.
People come give you note, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, and there's good reason to be paranoid. I mean, there's a lot of people trying to get your job all the time.
That's true.
And if the movie doesn't work, you know, you're not going to get called next fall. And, you know, so I think, that, you know, as an actor, if you're not paranoid, you're probably oblivious.
Right.
So I think I'd rather be paranoid.
So you mentioned briefly about this time, which I always think it was the glory days of movie making in our era. And like you said, I'm on top of the world, and I'm at CAA. I remember it's such a big deal. You know, you'd see actors and they had the red cover. That was the CAA.
Right.
The CAA red cover. I used to go, one day I'll have that red cover.
On a script, you mean, right?
Yeah, but there was a great, you know, there was an echelon and a respect, and making movies was great, and you go tour around the world, and there were junkets and all kind of stuff. Like, what were some of your headiest things that you did? Did you get yourself a house or a car?
No, I never did any of that. I was stupid. I was defiantly anti-publicity, being a movie star, and I actually, right after Memphis Belle, I ended up having a falling out with Kevin, because he wanted to make me a big movie star, and I was sort of like, I'm an actor, dude. Mm-hmm. And so I went off and did like 4 crappy independent movies in a year. I mean, they weren't all crappy, but they ended up, none of them moved the needle.
Right.
And I just wanted to show, look, I came from theater, I have a range. So
right.
I played like a Danish resistance fighter in World War II.
Yeah.
And I did the worst movie I ever did with Bridget Fonda, who's a very good person, and Cary Elwes, called Leather Jackets, the worst mm-hmm. movie ever made.
Mm-hmm.
I think it really is the worst movie ever
made.
It's
not the worst movie. Bobcat thinks his worst movie is Hot to Trot.
So a couple years later, a little side note on Leather Jackets. So I went to play baseball in Australia. I got it. This is me being stupid. Instead of going off to do another movie, I got a chance to play baseball in Australia for $75 a game and a plane ticket. So that made me a pro baseball player, which is what I had always wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this is after I was with Mr. Uvain anymore. So I was with another agent that will remain nameless. So I go for 4 months. I have the time of my life. And they have these roads in Australia. Have you spent any time in Australia?
I've just seen it.
Oh, you got to go. It's the most fascinating country. I mean, they have creatures there that are like, you know, not just the marsupials. They have lizards and snakes and things that are like from a million years BC. It's really cool. And the whole country is bigger than America, the landmass.
Mm-hmm.
But almost 99% of the population lives within 2 miles of the coast, wherever
right.
they live. So think of that mass middle. Mm-hmm. So anyway, when you try to drive into that middle, Australians are like, you know, in America, if somebody goes, if they're climbing in Yosemite and they get stranded on their rope, they send in a helicopter, they save you. The Australians are like, if you're stupid enough to do it, you're dead.
Yeah.
They don't set, so they have signs like, because sometimes you can go 1,000 miles without water or mm-hmm. fuel. So they'll have a sign with a skull and crossbones, and it says, unless you have 1,000 kilometers of fuel and water for 3 days, do not go this way. We're not coming for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of, me being whatever, I went like another mile or so, and it was like there was one more gas station. They were like, actually, we're the last chance. And I go in there, and this was in the time in the 90s when the gas station was often also the general store, you know, in, mm-hmm. in every country, and they'd have the rack of movies.
Right.
And any actor who says they haven't done this is a liar, but any time I went to a new country, I'd be like, oh, I wonder if they have any of my movies. So I go into the little gas station in the outback of Australia, past the Forbidden Zone, And I look through the rack, and it's like Top Gun and cool movies, and then it's like leather jackets. I was like, really? So it was. This is back when VHS was like $90 or whatever.
Yeah.
So I bought it, and then I drove another 12 miles into the desert, and I threw it as far as I could. It was worth it. I felt like I don't want people from Australia to experience me in that movie
in leather jackets.
In leather jackets, no way.
But you said but Bridget Fonda and Cary Elwes are wonderful people. I've worked with both. We've worked with a lot of the same people. So the so casting success aside, you know, there is always this interesting thing because there's no rule book for, you know, being successful. There's many rule books for trying to become successful.
Right.
But once you are successful, there's like, how do I stay successful? There's no, it's like you blink and then you can, you know, you can sort of screw things up. But the great thing about show business, I think, is that there's, you know, again, people always, you know, as they say, peaks and valley. All right. So let's get to Cutting Edge, your romantic comedy ice skating movie. And how the heck did that come about?
Well, I was kind of, you know, in a little bit of demand at that point. Yeah. And so I got offered two movies right at the same time. And one of them was The Mighty Ducks. And the other one was The Cutting Edge. And I love hockey. And so it was a hard choice.
Yeah.
But I read the script for The Cutting Edge, and I got emotional at the end of it. And Tony Gilroy, you know, who's probably the best writer in Hollywood these days, it was his first script.
Yeah.
And it made such an impression on me. That when the movie ended, the script ended, I was like, I was so moved by it, and I wasn't like the kind of movie that's geared at me necessarily, and I thought, well, that if it has that reaction to me, I think it's really going to work. So I went and met with them, and I didn't know how to skate, even though I was a huge hockey fan. I had no idea how to skate. So Robin Cousins was the skating choreographer.
Yes,
and they offered me the part, and they said, listen, there's just one little thing. We want to have our skating choreographer just check you out to see if you'll be able to, you know, do it.
Right.
We're going to fake it. We're going to have doubles. We're going to do all this stuff. And I said, okay, well, you know, but it was like Christmas time. And I was like, I don't want to go to California. And he's like, no, he'll come to New York. And they tried to set up a rink and everything, and they couldn't do it. So I ended up having to meet Robin Cousins at Rockefeller Center. And where, you know, and they actually cleared the ice for 20 minutes. So I could, and I couldn't skate. So it's me and Robin Cousins holding hands in front of all New York, and I guess I was athletic enough or whatever, and he gave a good report, and they were like, yeah, let's do it. So then it was one of those rare times where they weren't going to start shooting until April. So they were like, well, we have 3 months, so you want to train? We'll give you expense money. You can train. Mm-hmm. And Moira Kelly was from Long Island like me, and so that she hadn't skated either. So they hired this rink, Sky Rink, which is on the 9th floor on 9th Avenue.
I trained to die for.
Okay, there you go. So we're in Sky Rink, and every day I'd meet Moira there and Evelyn Kramer, our trainer, and some other people that were teaching me ballet dancing and all this other stuff. And we'd meet there at like 7 in the morning. And so Moira and I kind of learned to skate together. Mm-hmm. And it was such a great rehearsal process just because we didn't have to ever rehearse. We lived it together.
Right.
And they had a rule that, like, MGM bought the ice, so it was our ice.
Yeah.
But it was during figure skating time. And during figure skating time is only one sheet ice. There's no hockey. You can't have hockey skates on the ice during figure skating time.
Right.
But I said, that's just a rule when normal people are here. See, MGM bought the ice for us, so I can wear whatever skates I want, Moira. And she got so mad, and I thought, I know the whole movie.
Yeah.
And I wore my hockey skates every day. And I would take my figure skates with me, and I'd put them out, and we'd be getting our skates on. I'd take my figure skates out, and I'd like play with the laces and sort of make Moira think that today I was going to wear the figure skates. And then I'd put on my hockey skates, and she'd get mad. It was great. So we became great friends, and she became such a good skater that in the first week of filming, she was landing a spinning jump.
Wow.
And she broke her leg. So she doesn't skate in the movie at all. So I had to skate way more because they would show her stunt double was a good double for her. But so they'd show across her hair onto me. So now I'm skating all the time in the movie.
And it was
fun. It was hard work, but it was a really fun group of people. And, you know, Terry O'Quinn is one of the great guys. And
how do they film you skating? Because this was one of the issues we had in To Die For, where they kept saying, Oh, it looks like we're going to make the audience seasick. They couldn't figure out.
Can I stand up?
Yeah.
Is it high enough?
Yeah, I think okay.
Yeah, they'll get you from one of these.
So they built a turntable, like a 15-foot wooden turntable. And they had railings on it on one side. Mm-hmm. And then they had these little bars that would go up to about here. And Moira and I would have our outfits on in sneakers and hook your leg into this bar. They'd get five healthy Canadian guys on the other side by the camera to spin this thing around on the ice, and we would go like this.
I love it.
Ah. And so
most of it is like the doubles or one of us landing a jump, and then it's like, pretty good. And so I wish they had behind the scenes footage of it because it was so stupid. I mean, to watch.
Sounds like a Carol Burnett.
Yeah. It was. And but if they would spin it, it took a lot of trial and error because if they spun it too fast, we'd fly off. So they had to, or the camera would fly off, or and they'd move the turntable around the ice so that when they edited, they have the wide shots of the routine.
Yeah.
And then the moment when we talk, it cuts the, you know, so.
Oh my goodness.
So it's a classic.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, we don't have too much time. I want to talk about, very briefly, let's talk about Lonesome Dove, because that sort of changed television in a sense of, that was, you know, of course there was Roots and things like that, but that came along at a time like, you know, miniseries on television, big movie stars, and just being part of a Western, that must have been crazy. Larry McMurtry.
It was great. I got to meet Kevin Spacey around that time. He was not the big star, obviously, is now.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to be in Long Day's Journey into Night, so I went and saw him and Peter Gallagher and Jack Lemmon four or five times, and I got to know them. Anyway, during one of the after times having a drink after the show or whatever, he told me about Lonesome Dove. And he said, they're doing this. You got to be in it. And I was like, okay. And so I tried to figure out how to get in it.
Yeah.
And I met Dyson Lovell, who's a wonderful guy. He was from Rhodesia. He's a very South African gentleman. But they really wanted to have people that could ride because they were talking to Robert Duvall and they were talking to Tom. Nobody was hired yet. Mm-hmm. But they really wanted it to be authentic. Mm-hmm. I'd never ridden a horse in my life. I mean, except outside the grocery store with a quarter. But at this point, I've been around enough movies and I've done enough things that I know that, you know, I could probably fake it. Yeah. So he said, have you ever ridden a horse? And I said, Dyson, every summer I go to my uncle's ranch in Montana.
Oh, my God.
And I ride for a couple weeks. And so I haven't ridden in a few years, but I'm sure it would come right back to me. It was the best acting I've ever done in my life. And he nodded and he said, good, good, because everyone in the movie needs to be able to ride. So now, and then I get the job, and now it's like, I got to go ride. So I go to Central Park, and the horses in Central Park, I was like, I'll learn to ride. And so the horses in Central Park go around a ring. It's not really a riding experience, it's a sitting experience.
Yeah.
So I just thought, well, you know, whatever. If I get in trouble, I'll just tell them CBS is paying for the grass. If I try to get the horse to do something, like, you know, nudging it off the horse would like literally look around, look back at me and be like, I got this, pal. I know where the barn is, you know, and so like the horses did not want to hear from me trying to get them.
Yeah.
So I was like, that's not working. So Charlie Sheen and I had done two movies, No Man's Land and 8 Men Out. And he was down in Arizona shooting Young Guns. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I'll go down, I'll ride their horses, and then I'll go to the bar at night with those guys, because Kiefer Sutherland knows his way around a bar. And so that's what I did. I went down there, and I spent a couple weeks with that. And then Lonesome Dove, when they started assembling all the animals, we had, I think, 100 horses. We had 500 cattle, pigs of all ages for the different scenes. So they had to assemble this vast menagerie. They started doing it about 7 weeks before we filmed. So the first day they said they had horses, I flew to Austin. And I got there. I started riding every single day and made friends with the wranglers and started to learn tricks and, you know, and just to fake it, because you know, you can't become a good rider that fast. And Tommy Lee Jones finds out that they've hired somebody from Long Island to play Dish Boggett, a New Yorker, number one, a guy who can't ride or didn't know how to ride until 2 months ago. Like, he found out from the Wranglers. He decides he's going to get me injured and kicked out of the movie. So he invites me down to his house in San Saba, Texas, where he's got 300 acres, and he's a polo player.
Yeah.
And he puts, I didn't know this at the time, but he put me on an unbroken polo pony, hoping the polo pony would throw me. I'd get injured, I'd be out of the movie.
Oh, my God.
Tells you everything you need to know about Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah.
I did get thrown. Miraculously, I landed on my feet, which we were going down a thing, and the horse, and I was like, oh, my God, I'm alive. But I let go of the reins. The horse ran away, so I had to walk, like, you know, 2 miles back to the barn in very hot weather. And so, you know, I get back there, and Robert Duvall was there as well. And it was just the most humiliating thing. But I didn't know, I didn't really figure it out at the time. I thought I had made some mistake.
Right.
And so, you know, I was trying to get back in Tommy Lee's Good Graces. He kept complaining about all these mules that were like on his property eating his polo field.
Yeah.
So it being Texas, there's a rifle right on his porch. So I had cooked a lot back in New York days when I was trying to pay my tuition and after and so forth. So I grabbed the rifle, wild goats. Uh-huh. So I grabbed the rifle, I shot a goat. I butchered it on a tree in his front yard, and I made a stew out of it, and I put it in front of him and his ranch hands. And after that, I was okay with Tommy Lee Jones. Like, so
you
that
had
was
to kill a goat.
I had to kill a goat
and skin it,
and then I was okay with Tommy. Then I kind of took a little bit of the stink of New York off of me.
He went to Yale, though.
Harvard.
Harvard. Yeah.
But, roommates with Al Gore.
Yeah. And this tough. Well, that's that testosterone that I was talking about being on a set. So. You've done all these great films, been part of these, you know, great films, and then you sort of transition to directing. And is there one that you prefer? I mean, do you like to jump back and forth to acting and directing?
Well, I'd like to direct again. I mean, the problem with that movie was I financed it with my own money, everything I had, and everything I could borrow, and so I was the producer. And to be the producer and the director it's like being the dad and the mom. You know, you want to be one or the other,
right?
And so if I had to do another take and it was a meal penalty, I'd be like, that's like $2,000 out of my kid's college fund. But I need another take. I don't know. Yeah. And so I would love to direct another movie where there's a really seasoned producer who can take care of all that stuff, and I can just. So I've written several more scripts I want to direct again.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't even want to direct that movie. I was the best available director, though. Like, I asked Ed Harris to direct it, and he wasn't interested in directing it. Mm-hmm. And then I asked Ron Shelton to direct it. And,
wow.
And he was funny. He said he had just had three movies or something come out that didn't do well. And he was like, DB, I like your script, but if I direct your movie, they're going to say I can't get a studio job. Like, he was very honest about it. And, you know, or maybe that was just a nice way for him letting me down easy.
But, no, it sounds like a very truthful thing to say.
DB, we only have a minute or two left, but no, can you tell us a little bit about Haymaker?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Haymaker is, we're right in the midst of it right now, actually. Mm-hmm. It's the story of Nick Sasso is this guy who was a visual effects artist, and he had this experience where he met Nomi Ruiz, who is a transgender singer who's very popular in Brooklyn and nightclubs in Europe, and she's, you know, she's an underground sensation. He met her, and he's a married guy with a kid, and he had some strange feeling, like he didn't know if it was attraction or intrigue or whatever it was, and he had this feeling, and he wrote a movie about it. And so in the movie, he's a martial artist also, Nick. He plays a martial artist in the movie who becomes the bodyguard to Nomi Ruiz, the transgender singer, and I'm his older brother, and they have this very interesting non-relationship. Like, he's an employee. She shows him her world, and he sort of doesn't really understand it, and it ends up they don't have a romance, but they become really close friends, and he goes back and has a fight and goes back to being a fighter. And the movie ends with them coming face to face in the aftermath of the fight. And it's like, well, what happens next? And it's just very interesting and unusual. And the cool thing is that we shot 2 months ago, we shot the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Nick shut the movie down so that he can train and lose 20 pounds and get himself in tip top fighting condition to shoot the end of the movie. And they went and shot in Greece. It's like a $900,000 budget. They shot 2 times in L.A., 2 times in New York, Greece, and he's going to Thailand for a training sequence. Like, they go with, like, 3 people, like, micro crew.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love that he's swinging for the fences and that he's, you know, and I hope the whole movie works because he's just the kind of guy, you know, you want to get in his corner. You know, you want to get behind him.
Well, that's how movies are these days. You've, like, these micro, you know, micro budgets or doing television. What about some of these, you know, series like low budget on Amazon? I mean, we went through sort of similar times, so we've seen the movies just really dramatically a change. And has it been difficult finding your footing at all, just from watching? You know, that
to me
is the big challenge.
Well, I don't mind smaller crews. I like the smaller crews, but sometimes people use the budget and the size of the crew as an excuse,
right?
And other people see it as an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea of sitting down with 30 people and having lunch.
Right.
And I also like the idea that the director can get an idea and, oh, we're not going to do that, so let's go do this.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you have 150 people and all these trucks, you have to shoot what was planned and what was budgeted and all those things. So, and there are a lot of great crew people, but I find you don't need 150 people to make a movie unless you're trying to do Memphis Belle or Lonesome Dove or something. You know,
right.
Most stories, you just don't need all those people mm-hmm. because all those people are a plate at lunch and a parking space and everything is driven by the parking spaces for the trucks and the plates at lunch instead of like what would be cool in the scene today.
Right.
So I do like the idea of the smaller movies, but unfortunately a lot of people are not getting paid what they feel like they deserve and they mm-hmm. use that as an excuse not to do their best work.
Right. And also what I find hard is that you don't have the time, like you said, to table read the idea that,
right.
to spend time with your co-stars and get to know people. Well, anyway, you have to come back here
yes.
and talk
Thank
some
you.
More.
It's so fun.
So
please.
I've never done anything like this where you talk. I'm sorry if I didn't give too long answers
no.
or anything.
So.
No, it was wonderful.
You're such a funny storyteller.
Oh, they're so good. DB's website is dbsweeney.com. He's at RealDBSweeney on Twitter. Thank you very much. Yes. You can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis
yes,
Hopper, on Amazon and also in bookstores. It's out in paperback. You should buy it. Also, take a look at our Facebook page. Our website is ilianaspodcast.com.
What's your favorite Humphrey Bogart movie? Do you have a favorite?
It's hard not to say Casablanca because I've seen it the most times, but Maltese Falcon.
Oh, so good.
I like that one better. I just feel like he's nastier in that.
You know, it's interesting. I was talking about James Cagney because I'm on a James Cagney kick. And early Humphrey Bogart was, you know.
He was the third guy on the right in seven different Cagney movies.
So great.
Yeah.
And then I think he broke through with Maltese Falcon. Was that his game changer?
Yeah.
The change? What about In a Lonely Place?
Love it. High Sierra. I mean, they go on. African Queen is right there.
Treasure of Sierra Madre.
I mean, it's an embarrassment of riches. And he used to complain that he didn't get the good lines.
I know. He was really grumpy. From what I've read, like from Raoul Walsh and stuff,
right.
He was a big complainer, but fantastic actor. As we always say on the show, everyone's life is a movie. Yours has became a movie with a beginning, middle, and an end. And this is sadly the end of this show. But please come back, DB. It's been an honor and so much fun to talk to you,
of course.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you very much.
Bye, hon.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.